This is Ozarks at Large. Gerald Sloan lives in Fayetteville, and he was a music professor at the University of Arkansas for years. He's been a poet for quite a while, too. His second collection, Crossings, a memoir in verse, has just been published. Tomorrow night, he'll discuss and read from the book at Nightbird Books as the guest of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. During a conversation in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News studio last week, he discussed his poems that consider many things, including his childhood years in a small eastern Oklahoma town.
Grew up in a railroad town, and many of the people in my family worked for the Kansas City Southern, and my house that I lived in for about 10 years was situated almost too close to the railroad track, so that was everyday part of our lives, you know, the sounds of passing trains. So if you want to look at the front cover is the engine and the rear cover is the caboose, and there's 110 line poems, that you might view them as a freight train with a series of boxcars, because back in the days before we got our first TV, one of the most exciting things you could do in this small town where I grew up was go out and count the cars on a train. And if you found one that had more than 100 cars, that was a big day.
And this was in Heavener.
Heavener, Oklahoma, right.
Tell me about Heavener, and then I'll tell you what I know about Heavener. But it was in eastern Oklahoma, small railroad town. But it was packed with things for you to do as a child. That's one thing I picked up from these poems.
Well, I kind of tucked this in at the end of the book, and it's not very well produced, but this belt buckle for the Heavener Centennial was actually designed by my father, who was such a maven that he was into all kinds of things, including collecting antiques. But the photograph didn't reproduce the details of the buckle, which is the Kansas City Southern and the depot and the deer. They had a little deer park there where people would go feed cigarettes to the deer. That's a crazy detail that I happen to remember. They like tobacco. And the Peter Conser House, I think he was a historic Native American early pioneer. The Cedar Lake and then off into the Ouachita Mountains. Maybe the Runestone, certainly. I've got a poem about that. And it was a state park for a while until the Republicans defunded it, so now it's fallen back on local funding.
Well, okay, you brought up the Runestone because I've been to Heavener, and I went to Heavener because of the Runestone.
Oh.
And it's this sort of glorious legend, this Runestone that is not easy to get to. You write in a poem about it that it was even more difficult when you were young.
Right.
Some people will claim that Vikings came because it has these glyphs on it. Others say, it's an elaborate prank that has survived decades.
Well, I don't want to get off onto some kind of historic, by road or something, but that was actually my Sunday school teacher when I was 4 years old. Her name was Gloria Farley, and she's written the most extensive book about the Heavener Runestone, and she's heavily invested and convinced the Chamber of Commerce to promote it this way, that it was the Vikings who worked their way into that area back, you know, over 1,000 years ago. Well, there's another Heavener resident who has published a counter-narrative that I mentioned in one of the sort of more arcane notes to the book. Let's see. His name was Dr. Lee W. Woodard. Published a counter-narrative called Seven Gnomes at Wicked Fork Where LaSalle Died, which argued that the runes were left by a ragtag group of Frenchmen in 1687 following the murder of their leader on the Fourche Moline, a tributary of the Poteau River now at the bottom of Wister Lake. It reads like a cliffhanger mystery but seems more plausible than the Viking theory. They used runes to avoid detection by Spanish soldiers who owned and patrolled the region at that time. Et cetera, et cetera.
Do you mind reading Runestone on page 50?
Okay. Back before there was easy access, our scout troop trekked up the side of Poteau Mountain to Kitchen Canyon, ate our sack lunches under an overhang, water trickling from a wet weather spring. We stretched before ogling the vertical slab with its 8 etched mysterious characters left behind by Indians or drunken hunters, though Miss Farley insisted the markings were the handiwork of early Vikings.
So it was.
So the hearsay amongst people who didn't pay much attention to it was that maybe Indians had done it, or maybe some drunken hunters, deer hunters, did it as a prank. So Miss Farley's, theory. Obviously, she was very passionate promoting it, piqued a lot of interest, and there were other runestones in that area. There's a runestone near Poto, and throughout the United States, I think they've got books documenting other runestones as far away as Minnesota. So I don't know if Mr. Woodard's counter-narrative would explain all of that, but one of the strange connections in life is that the gentleman who published my book, Gary Coover, who lived in Fayetteville on Ralston Street, and of course he lives in Hawaii now, but he called his press Ralston Press, is one of the few people I know who's kind of a scholar on American runestones and owns Gloria Farley's book, which I don't even own, even though I knew her personally. So one of the many intersections in life that makes things interesting.
If I can find it, I'll give you my copy of her book.
Oh, you did?
I interviewed her 20 years ago, yeah.
Unbelievable. I didn't know that, Kyle.
There are stories about your childhood, but there are poems in here that reach back before you were born. Did your family pass down stories and legends and tales of ancestors?
Certainly, and I'm old enough now to have more years behind me than in front of me, and I think because of that phenomenon, I'm looking backwards more, trying to figure out how we got to be the way we are and why, and how poetry is related to memory. And to be very honest, a lot of these memories are not mine. They're my mother's, who will be 91 next week. And so to promote them as my personal memories is not accurate. So I'm just kind of a transmitter here, passing on some things. And if they turn out to be not entirely true, then that's kind of the way memory works. If you go to a family reunion and start talking about the past, you may have five people that remember the same event five different ways or maybe totally disagree. So this is like a time-lapse video of my life, except the images are verbal instead of photographic, except for Rick Squire's photographs here, which are not intended to illustrate any particular poem. They're just supposed to evoke similar feelings about the region that we live in.
Why'd you decide to include photographs from Rick Squire's?
Because for at least 30 years I wanted to do a poetry collection with some kind of photographs. I don't know if it's my right brain, pleading for a recess or something. But, you read six or eight poems, and then you can go to your right brain and just enjoy some kind of nonverbal image.
There is more than a bit of mortality openly and subtly discussed in your poems.
Right. Well, that starts at the beginning and ends in the last poem, which is kind of an elegy to my grandmother. So there's grandparents in the poems, and also an extended sequence about my father and some of the conflict that we had and adjusted to eventually. And so it's sort of about reconciliation with my father. There's kind of an arch to, these mosaics, reconciliation with my father, I think.
We've mentioned that trains are prominent in these poems. Baseball on the radio. Your grandmother loved the Yankees.
Right.
You mentioned your baseball mitt a couple of times.
Right.
It gathered dust when the TV made it to the house.
Right.
Movies.
Very important. Since I retired 4 years ago, I have a movie group that meets at my house once a month. And so we've been traversing the world of film. And I grew up in this small town where literally before we had TV, there was nothing to do except go to the movies. And that's what my mother did, especially when my father was away in the service. So that shaped my thinking, especially musically, as much as any other force.
I did not know until I went to a theater in Miami, Oklahoma, that for years the theaters would hold a lottery.
Oh, yes.
And you write about this in the poem on page 36, We Won It at the Movies.
Right.
Would you mind reading that?
Okay. Do I need to explain the,
sure,
the subtitle?
Sure. Oh, yes, to the critic, yes.
We won it at the movies, with apologies to Pauline Kael, who was the movie critic for the New York New Yorker magazine for many years, and she wrote a memoir called "We Lost It at the Movies." So, I thought I at least needed to drop her name since I sort of played on her title. We won it at the movies. We learned more from formula cinema than we did from church or public schools. There was little else to do in my hometown. Dad away in the Navy. Mom, not so much a movie fan as she was keen on winning the weekly drawing. So our second home became the Liberty Theater, where we saw the Saturday serials and studio pot boilers. And Mother finally won a GE steam iron, which she used until the cord wore down.
And these lotteries would happen weekly.
Right.
And so there was a chance. I know that some gave away cash, some gave away prizes.
We literally did go every week, and then I would go alone on Saturdays occasionally. And sometimes my grandparents, the book is sort of organized geographically. There's eight or ten poems at the beginning, sort of a prologue, and then there's an epilogue at the end that looks back from the present and being a grandparent myself now. And I've dedicated the book to my grandchildren, of which I have five now. But the three interior chapters, which are longer, I decided to organize geographically. The first group of poems takes place in Hevener. The second group takes place in Howe, which is a little hamlet about 10 miles from Hevener, where my paternal grandfather lived. And then the third group takes place in Fort Smith. We border hopped when I was 12. So I encountered an English teacher there at Northside, John Taylor. I'm not sure if he's still living, who got me interested in literature, and I was lucky enough to have him 2 years in a row, and including taking a course in world literature, which kind of sparked my interest in writing.
You have a great line in one of the poems that you started in a town that has heaven in its name, Hevener, mm-hmm. and then you eventually, as you put it, border hop when you're 12, and you go to a place that used to be known as Hell on the Border.
Well, that may be, I may have out-clevered myself.
I don't think so.
Would you mind if I read that?
I love that.
Leaving Hevener. It started like one of God's little jokes, a hick town that spelled out heaven, my hometown in eastern Oklahoma, on the west side of Poto Mountain, where the foothills heaved up children. Then we border hopped to Arkansas, a place once called Hell on the Border, Fort Smith created to restore the order between Osage and evicted Cherokees, from heaven to hell at the age of 12.
Gerald Sloan's latest collection of poems is titled Crossings, a memoir in verse published by Ralston Press. He'll read from the book tomorrow night at Nightbird Books in downtown Fayetteville as the latest guest speaker of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. That event begins tomorrow night at 7. And on Weekend Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9 on 91.3 KUAF, more from our conversation.